Help us, Google Fiber. You're our only hope. Episode 125 of the Furler Bros Tech Podcast.
Welcome to episode 125 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 15th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my love-struck brother, James Furlough.
Have you ever watched the YouTube version of this podcast?
Yes. Once.
So then you know that it doesn't actually show the two little boxes that you and I see. It just shows the main screen.
Yes. Okay. So all that dancing
for me.
Every single week. I do that knowing that you're the only person that sees it. It's sort of like a little bit of a. It's like a. What I really like is I know Keegan knows that. You know, like he obviously doesn't because I don't play that music for him when we do. Whatever. It's besides the point. It's just for you. I'm a nice brother like that. It's my gift.
Good Valentine's gift.
You're welcome. Did you have a good Valentine's Day?
Yeah. What did we do? I don't know. We watched some I Hate Valentine's Day, I think was the name of the movie last night on Netflix.
Nice.
And it had a lot of the same characters, or the two main characters from My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Hmm.
But you could tell they did it on like a tenth of the budget.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of weird and goofy, but it was good. It was good.
Nice.
Super predictable, like most movies are nowadays, but that's all right.
I went and saw The Little Mermaid.
Oh.
It's they've released it on digital and Blu-ray and stuff, so it's that and The Jungle Book. So doing like this special engagement at my local theater. So it's like $5. You get to go and see The Jungle Book or The Little Mermaid. And Little Mermaid was up on the docket last night, so we went. And I got to be honest, dude. It's a fantastic movie. Me and our cousin Timmy. It was kind of like two 20, 27-year-old dudes in the movie theater watching Little Mermaid and like a bunch of kids and 15-year-old girls judging us and just like, you know, moms and stuff. It was like, well, you know, like, what are you two doing here? Like, dude, we're stockholders, I think, or maybe, you know. we're like the Little Mermaid, okay? So whatever.
Yeah, you're right. And I think Abu the Monkey's hilarious too.
Yeah, well, see, we didn't get to see.
Oh, wait, you're right. That's the wrong movie.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of
Aladdin?
The Candle and the Clock Guys. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I know. What is wrong with you? You know what's really weird to think about? That, so you've got like,
P.S. I totally knew I was saying the wrong movies, just for the record.
I know. I appreciate it. Okay. That's why I'm...
That wasn't for you.
You let that linger. I was going to say, you know what's crazy to think about? This is what's nuts to me. Okay, so you know how you got The Little Mermaid, and like, think about the time frame of, like, when that was coming out, like, what the world was like, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now think about this. It was only 3 years later that Toy Story came out. I don't know why, but I was like, I have it in my brain that, like, because there are these animated movies, they're all, like, old. I don't, you know, it's like, they're not of the modern era, and because Toy Story is all CG, I have this, like, mindset that, you know, it's new, it's of the modern era. But the fact that they're, like, there's only 3 years of bridging them. Little Mermaid was 89, Toy Story was 92. It's like, whoa. Whoa. Yeah, it's
because crazy. And then they had a pretty good run, right? Where they did it was Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. And
right.
Then they kind of went off the rails with Pocahontas, right?
Yeah, something
like
that.
Kind of the order.
I think that's so. I'm I'm an expert on many things, James, but that exact order, I am not the expert on.
Well, there was a cool, what was it? Man, I can't remember, honestly, if it was Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast. I feel like it was Beauty and the Beast. But what happened was, and this was in the special features for it, where they were talking about how you had, like, Disney had animators, obviously, and, you know, they had done some amazing work, right? You think in Snow White, Bambi wasn't that great, but you had Snow White and Cinderella, and I feel like there was one other one there that I'm forgetting about, but, these animators who had done these feature-length films who were, you know, quite literally pioneers in the animation industry, right? Yeah. And then they took a little break, and then they kind of got back to it. And they said what happened was they had a whole bunch of new people, animators, in there, and they had all these older animators there. And they said, and they just kind of put them all together in this big room and said, okay, we're going to make another movie. It's going to be called Little Mermaid. And, you know, and they were just like, they go, it was amazing. And they were just talking about how much fun it was to work together and how you had all these guys who were like highly skilled, had a ton of experience, were amazing at their job. And then you had, you know, the guys with just a ton of energy and the creative juices were just flowing like crazy. And so they said they produced some of like just amazing, amazing movies. And they also talked about how, you know, the music obviously plays a huge role.
Yeah.
Huge role. And I forget who the guy was, because he got cancer pretty young in life, and so he died early. And he was the guy who wrote all the songs. Yeah. And, you know, and he was the one who was like, you know, if we have a lot of explaining to do about something, we'll just sing it in a song, and we can do it really fast. And so he came up with that concept. And
pretty funny.
Yeah, and, you know, and so that's why all their songs, like, they're not just, you know, like a classic musical. They're singing, they're dancing. It doesn't really move the story forward.
Yeah.
Whereas with Disney, it moves the story forward. You don't get bored because they're telling you what's happening through song. Yeah. And that was the guy who...
Montage!
Yeah. And so he was the guy who came up with that idea. And then I believe they did the same thing for Beauty and the Beast, and which is why it's just one of those best movies ever type things.
Right.
And then Disney decided that they wanted to go to an every, because they were doing that like every other year, and they decided they wanted to do an every year release date. And so what they did, split the teams in two. So they had one team work on one project for 2 years, and then they somehow, you know, they took a break, and then another team worked on a project for 2 years so they could do an every year release cycle. And so they split them up, and they just went, that was the end of a specific era, and they began a new era. And it sounds like at that same time, and it sounded like it was just timing, right?
Yeah.
Pixar was doing their thing. And P.S., by the way, like for the first 3 or 4 movies, Pixar used that same model. Everyone is working on the same movie at the same time. We're not doing, you know, and so that was why Toy Story came out, and it seemed like it was like 3 years before another movie came out. And it was, yeah, that's how long it
Right, and it really wasn't until Toy Story 2 that they, you know, you got the first round of, the team was broken up, and what's his name, the dude who...
Lasseter.
Lasseter wasn't in charge of it. They let Lasseter watch it once, and Lasseter was like, Jobs is gonna kill us all, we need to make this better. And then Lasseter started to, you know, pick apart little pieces of it, trying to remake it subtly so it wouldn't be awful, and then ended up completely remaking it, and it was arguably better. It's funny. I mean, you take Lasseter's body of work and you go, obviously he's a genius. When you take specific stories like Toy Story 2 and sort of like how that all evolved, you're just like, yeah, he's smart. He's talented.
Well, yeah, and is it any surprise that, you know, he oversaw the movie Frozen and helped write that?
Not at all.
Oh, yeah, and so I look at that, and it was like, I wish I could remember this guy's name. I just don't. That music guy. It's just amazing how all it takes is one or two people to completely change the direction and the outcome of something and to make it something special.
It's funny to bring this back around to the tech industry. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I've always been if you're on this show, I've always said I really think that, you know, Apple was more than one man, and it had, you know, it wasn't a one man show, and putting all the emphasis on Steve Jobs was wrong. There were things that he was brilliant at, but he was not the only person there. You know, Tim Cook was a big part of that. You know, Johnny Ives is a huge part of what makes Apple brilliant. And you know, just, you know, these different, you know, Schiller and this guy and that guy, and like, you just like, it's an entire team. It wasn't a one man show. And then you have stories like that where you're like, I mean, it was Jobs found Lasseter, and Lasseter made it great. You know, and what do you want us to do with Toy Story? Make it great. You're like, what the heck is that?
Jobs
didn't
find Lasseter, but
that's a good point. Because Lasseter was already working for. Technically, Lucas found him, right?
The timing was pretty close on that.
Yeah, I
don't think so. They didn't. Jobs owned Pixar by the time Lexo Lamp came out, and one of Jobs' gifts was the ability to see genius in someone.
Yeah.
And go, you need to do more.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, they were even like, this is a fun, super fun story. I read a biography, listened to a biography about Pixar a year ago. Man, really? Nah. Yeah, almost. Maybe 9 months ago. Anyways, so I listened to this. Yeah, because we were fixing up our duplex, and I remember listening to it. Okay, I'm back. They were talking about how they were trying to make computers, you know, computer graphic type stuff, and that was why Jobs bought it to create another hardware business to kind of hedge on Next.
Right.
And so on the side, they were like, we need to somehow show the capabilities of these computers and what they can do. And so it was one of the other manager folks connected with Lasseter because he wanted to do a Brave Little Toaster using CG with Disney. And he wanted to tell the story in a
Lasseter made Brave Little Toaster. Oh, my God.
No, he didn't make it. That was the problem. He wanted to, and Disney wouldn't let him tell the story the way that he wanted to tell it because it was too edgy or something like that. And, you know, and so – and he wanted to push the bounds of the art style, like using 3D art. And they're just like, no, that we're not that kind of company. And so I don't remember if he got fired or you know, he – left on mutual terms, but you know, he just did not get along well with the Disney folks at all, and so he left. Yes, later on Disney did make Brave Little Toaster, and from what I understand, it's nothing like what he actually had in mind, which is interesting.
It's still a beloved movie and one of the most terrifying kids movies of all time.
I know, right? Right? So I'm sure that was part of their, you know, I'm sure there's part of it that was from that. But anyways, so he came and his job was to like try to, you know, help prove the technology. And they couldn't hire like an animator. And so he was a computer technician kind of thing. And, you know, helping to test the software out. Yeah, he's like, yeah, I wasn't officially an animator. And so he had to learn how to program and how to do all this. And they decided to – he made that Luxo Lamp movie, and they shared it with Jobs, and he was like, oh, well, that's cool. He liked it, and they ended up – they shared it to whatever, the Sundance Film Festival or, you know, one of those short film festivals.
Yeah.
And, you know, won like crazy. And everyone says, like, the insight wasn't the fact that the graphics were amazing. It was just – somehow he had imputed these human characteristics onto a lamp, and you know, and you connect.
It's just, yeah.
I mean, it's classic him, right? I mean, that's what he's known for. And what I thought was interesting for him, he, you know, his whole like his thing, he, you know, his storytelling thing is you have something. That he goes, you have a natural state, which works really well with toys. You know, toys like to be played with, was his example.
Yeah.
you know? And he goes, and so give them their natural state and then take that away from them or threaten it. And then just see how would you react if you didn't get that anymore? And yeah. I mean, that's the Toy Story, you know, storyline right there.
Right. That, yeah, it's plus, I mean, yeah. It's and I mean, what I love about all of this is that I just love the brilliance of the creative process and that sort of thing. Cause it's, you know, as oftentimes the greatest stories that have ever been written are incredibly simple. They're just, they're there are stories that are wonderful in their complexity, but there are stories that, you know, on the flip side, some of the most, you know, some of my favorite, most brilliant stories are just, we did one thing and just asked the question, like you said, what happens now? How do they react to this? You know, we're not trying to make anything, you know, and it just flows naturally. But what I love about this almost, and this is, you know, and to just bring it back around a little bit.
Yeah.
It was the guy in charge realized that what he bought, what George Lucas was buying, was what George Lucas built, was a tool to make Star Wars type movies. What Steve Jobs bought was a graphics based company to, you know, to help with his operating system company. And what it became was a tool for a brilliant artist. And Steve Jobs said, okay. You know, it was just like,
yeah.
And that's, you know, and that, and it's, and that, that, you know, like, you know, when they talk about what Steve Jobs was great at, it was, they've always said it's, you could just, he could be completely wrong and be all right with it. And he'd think he was right all the time. And that's a perfect example of what you lose is, A, like you said, the insight into brilliance, just the fact that he looked at people and he could see people who were brilliant and just pulled more out of them. And I think in general, he pulled more out of everybody. And so he just highlighted, if you had a little brilliance, he made you seem really smart, you know, even more brilliant because, you know, because he could pull it out of you. If you were actually a genius, he could make you just, you know, legendary. And then the other thing that he does, and that, they, you know, he's legendarily, you know, this is what everybody says, is that whole idea of he bought the company for the wrong reason. He did, you know, he's got this company, he's got this new product, and he's just like, yeah, sure, we'll become a movie company. What? That's not what this is, you know.
And they talk about how, like, they do board meetings where they'd have to ask him for tons of money because they were losing money hand over fist.
Yeah.
And they always felt so bad about it. And he was always super critical. And then they get done and be like, "So, when's the next short coming out? Can I see it yet?" You know. And so he always just had this, like, you know, he didn't like how the company was going. And then this one, they were always like, "Yeah, he liked it." You know, which just meant he could tell something was there. And they were like, "Should we invest more?" He's like, Not yet. Let's feel it out. And I don't remember if Disney approached Pixar or the other way around. They probably, Pixar was like, you know, we could make a feature length film. And they went, yeah, but we can't afford it. And that was where Jobs went to bat and, you know, did all the hard negotiating. But I think this is also, you know, this points out why we spent so much time talking about Satya Nadella at Microsoft last week, because, like, that's critically important. He is in a role where he's going to have to identify those people, identify that genius, and go, you know what, you're onto something. I may not fully understand it, and 3-5 years from now, it may look completely different, but there's something about that I like. Right. Keep going. I'm going to put you in charge of something. I'm going to give you some money to explore it, and let's see where that goes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and that's the fun part about, you know, what we do and why we like looking at startups, and because, you know, they're onto something. They, you know, they've seen something. We don't always fully understand what it is, and sometimes it, you know, it doesn't last very long. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but there haven't been like any articles about Snapchat recently. They kind of went big time, and now it's. I'm sure they're still doing fine.
Yeah,
but yeah, the infatuation with that's gone. So, anyways. Yeah.
You know,
so
and it's funny.
I agree with you that Little Mermaid was a great movie and a great example of, you know, just a great product that touches people's hearts.
And yeah, thank you for bringing it back around. Because, I mean, because this week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. But what we love about it, and it's funny, I hope every once in a while we dive into a little bit of why this is our opening statement, what it is about the corporate opera, because this is what's fascinating. It's the people involved in it. It's their dramas. It's how it's how they interact. It's, you know, when we say this, you know, the corporate opera, we talk about the soap opera of corporations, what, you know, how they're all interrelated, the people working for them, because like you said, that's critically important. Their marketing campaigns, because that's how they convey themselves to us. And, you know, and then lastly, and, you know, excitingly, but really lastly, the actual products they're making, because, you know, and I hope that if there's anything different about our show, that announcing new products and asking sales figures, those are all really secondary to the creative process and the relationships that are being built and understanding the foundations of how these things work, because, you know, you can get product announcements from anybody. Understanding how they fit into the larger ecosystem of all these companies and therefore where they've been, where they're going, that I'm hoping is our brilliance. We'll let you decide.
but right.
Yeah, so before we do get into the heart of the show, which I know it feels like we're already there, James has got a short disclosure he's got to throw our way.
I work for HP, but do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions. Not as important this week, will become super important next week.
What's going on next week?
HP is releasing a product today that I'm going to wait until next week to talk about.
Oh, okay, cool. Coo-coo-coo-choo.
Because I kind of want to see everyone else's reviews first.
Before you chime in. It's amazing. Everybody's like, it's terrible. I mean,
because I'm super biased. Because I've been working on it for like a year. So.
Yeah. That'll be that. You know what? Yeah. I feel you. I hope it. You know what? I'll take a measured approach when I look at it in a week when I get back from Spain. If you want to follow us throughout the week, you know, check out our you know, what we're doing in the social media world. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is Next Week in 4. This is a good week to be following me because, as I just mentioned, I'm going to be in Spain, which means I'll have all sorts of cool pictures that try to they're not called selfies. They're called braggies.
I love those.
I'm in Spain, everybody. Would you like my pictures? I live such a cool life. But seriously, I have a pretty cool life.
How many hours do you leave?
I am going.
How many hours?
My flight is at 3:30. I got to be at Espo at 1:30, which means I got to leave here.
Yeah, ton of time.
I got to leave here at 12:30, which means I'm gonna have to be eating lunch with my ride at 11:30. So I've actually got not as much time as I'd like, but it is.
That happens.
What it is, yeah.
It's coming up fast. You can follow me, jamesfurlow.com. I will not be in Spain. My pictures will not be as cool. And you can also find me on Twitter, at jamesfurlow.
And if you want to go just and see all this information where everything's collated into one helpful resource, go to furlowbros.com. Not .guru, not .net, not .org, not .whatever, all the different top-level domains possible, but .com, the true top-level domain.
Record, we have referenced last week's show twice, so if you haven't listened to that, you really should.
Yeah, get on it. what was I going to say? Oh, on that website, on that brilliant website, we've got all sorts of cool resources about the show. All the articles that we talk about, brilliant articles, none of them we've talked about so far, but all the ones we're about to talk about, we link all those so that you can get all those resources yourself. Also, the link to the YouTube video that we talked about earlier, and link to the podcast, including the show cuts, shorter snippets of the show, and then make the whole thing a little bit more bite-sized if you can't handle a two-hour show. It's funny. Every time I talk to my friends, they're like, how long do you do the show for? I'm like, 2 hours. And they're like, wow, that's a really long time. I'm like, have you met me? Like, You really think that's a long time?
We were friends.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, no. It's but if it's a little hard for you to handle, we understand. We get it. We've been told. and we're trying to make it convenient
don't
for
care.
You. Yes, exactly. We care
we're making
enough.
A product that we love, and we are desiring customers who love it just like we do.
Exactly. This is a premium product for premium
customers.
Yeah.
There you go.
Love it.
I read some book that was about attracting perfect customers at one time, but that was back when I cared about marketing. Oh, wait, I still do.
Uh-huh.
I still do.
All right. Let's do this.
Yeah.
So this is a good time of year. Do you ever follow the Crunchies?
You know, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. This year I did not get to.
This was a year where I don't normally follow the Crunchies, and I don't know why, whatever, but I probably will follow it. Yeah, well, aren't all awards
made up?
Yeah, I was gonna say it's funny. We actually, you know, part of founding a fraternity is you get to make up the first round of awards, and it's really weird. Like years later, you know, it's because we're part of a national fraternity. Some of them are set out for us, but some of them are like the local ones. And like, it's funny talking, like, you know, it's been almost a decade now. And, like the new kids, like that are coming into the fraternity have no knowledge. They're like, to them, these just have always existed. And they're like, you know, I mean, like, these are, you know, they, and it's just, it's weird to see them look at awards as like these things that have always been, and they've like, they're, you know, these meaningful things. And we're like, dude, half of those were jokes. I can't believe you take them seriously. Like, what the heck?
That's funny.
But
that means we got to come up with some awards. We have to have an award show.
Dude.
Okay.
That's, you know what? You know what we really need to do? We need a completely off-season award show. Because everybody else, like July, like, you know, made it through the Christmas excitement awards. It's actually not a bad idea. But anyways.
Surviving summer. Okay, yeah, exactly. All right. Noodle on this.
Yeah, this is kind of...
Man, I wish we lived next to each other. We'd actually, like... it would be great. Oh, well. It is what it is.
You know what, James? Come on down. There's plenty of space.
If only there was a way that we could like do this virtually.
I know,
where
exactly.
Where it seemed like we were together.
Yeah, like there are all these companies that you'd think would be able to deliver something like that, but you know, whatever. So anyways,
you know, if there was like an award-winning company that could help us do that.
Exactly. Come on, guys. So the two
I'm really trying hard to set you up here.
I know, thank you. So the two that I thought you were talking about Google. I was like, you mean like Google Huddle? Like, yeah, that'd be awesome.
No.
The two there's two, number one, the opening monologue by John Oliver of Daily Show fame. Pretty funny. Just him ragging on the tech, on all these techies, just making fun of them was it's pretty golden. I mean, like, that's his thing. Like, he's just like, what is this? This is stupid. You're all dorks. Go away. And like, he kind of gets, it's funny. He kind of gets off into like the NSA, like privacy stuff. And it's like, this is just sad, John. Like, this isn't funny anymore. Like, this is terrible. And then he gets back into making fun of the tech people, like, that's right, you're so funny. but the two awards that I thought were most interesting or exciting, because I like them, was number one, best hardware startup goes to Oculus Rift. I'm so stoked for this company.
So they won an award even though they haven't started selling them yet.
Yeah, because they're a startup. Well, technically, they started selling, like, the dev kits. You can buy the dev kits.
And actually,
you want to know why I know this? Because I've gotten so excited about them in the last few weeks. I actually went to their website and was, like, looking at how much a dev kit costs and the different components you need. Was looking at my bank account. I was like, this is stupid. What are you doing?
Wow.
Stop it. And
just out of curiosity, what's the approximate cost to get in on that?
$200 for the hardware for just the Oculus Rift,
which is not bad.
Which is why
Glasses will call you $1,500 from Google.
Which is why I was pretty tempted. But the problem is all it is really and truly is a monitor, a $200 monitor. You need a game. You need a piece of hardware, a rig that can do the rendering. So if you want to play like the 3D games and stuff, you need a hardcore computer. And I have been like militantly, I don't play video games. It's just not true. But my last like three computers have had integrated graphics card because like I used to buy the top of the line computer so that I could do anything on it. And that didn't really like, I appreciated it and the computers lasted a long time, but if I was honest with myself, I never used them to their full potential. So I decided I'd buy computers that I knew I was going to use everything on. So like I upgrade the processor like crazy, but I don't really use the graphics card. Oh, now I'm like coming back around. Like I should have gotten a graphics card. So I think that the total cost of ownership for a really nice Oculus Rift level device is going to be kind of a steep purchase for me. So A, it means I have to save for it, so I'm not, you know, so I can act like a mature adult. Because those sorts of things just not healthy to do impulsively.
That's true. I'm going to wait until they port over Second Life, and then I'll be in.
Oh, man. And then, yeah, and the other thing is I want some actual titles. I want some games to play. And, you know, to me, if I can just watch movies, I think that's a good enough, like, use. Because I love, like, really immersive 3D movies. That sounds awesome. I'm super stoked. But you know, unless there's a couple of games that I can share with my friends and stuff, I don't, you know, it's good. But so they won. Congratulations. Go Oculus Rift. They're becoming they're slowly becoming my new darling sweetheart company. But the other one, and this just seems like cheating. Like I understand why you have to include this company in this competition, in this part of the, in this category, but it's like you don't let anybody else compete. How about you just like walk away from it? But Kickstarter won the Crunchy for best overall startup.
I got a Kickstarter project on my wrist.
Almost everybody that was competing was a Kickstarter project. Like Oculus Rift was a Kickstarter project. Actually, it's funny. What I thought was really interesting was that a couple of the – it's actually its biggest like competitors like GoPro and stuff were not Kickstarter projects. But you're like, yeah, I mean – you are giving awards for startups. The guys that make startups, I could see how they would have a leg up in that particular competition.
They created a very cool platform.
Oh, I mean, it's brilliant. I think they absolutely deserve it. I mean, I guess why I'm making fun of it is because they so clearly deserve it that it's a joke that you even ask the question. It's brilliantly powerful, and the very fact that the Crunchies exist and all of the projects that are shown on it are, you know, Kickstarter type. You know, they're either Kickstarter type projects or they're actually Kickstarter projects. That fact alone tells me that, you know, yeah, it absolutely deserves this. It is as awesome as it sounds. And, you know, at this point, I'm waiting on one more Kickstarter project. And, you know, coincidentally, no, I'm waiting on two more. But the one that's going to come last, just from the time frame of it all, definitely the one I invested in first. but Parallela is getting their act together, and they're actually going to deliver it to me, which is a better place than they were in November of last year. They completely run out of money.
Oops.
Which is a bummer because it's a really cool product, and I was like, and they basically, you know, actual development cost. They basically sold them for the cost for a little bit under what they'll sell them in the end, which I don't think they expected that to happen. And so they needed some more money to kind of, you know, keep it going. But so they got some big investors. It's a good company. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's just
congratulations.
Yeah. And I think Kickstarter is just a super interesting platform. It's just one of those, like, the rules, they were working on it, and then they had a law change that just the timing couldn't have been more perfect, to where you just go, oh, duh.
Yep, what was the law that changed?
They changed how you could receive funding. It was all about the funding and investment laws and stuff. And I mean, and they were already working on ways to get around it. And they just, you know, they came in and really, I don't remember it exactly because I'm not a lawyer and I really don't care that much. But it was, what in the world is going on over there?
I don't know. I can't even tell that anything's wrong.
Okay. And that law changed and the timing was really well for them, and which is another reason why a bunch of those peer-to-peer lending things are now popping up. That was semi-related to that, and just the crowdfunding changes. But yeah, a brilliant idea. It was good. We weren't all really sure if it was going to work or not, because you know it was kind of like, can they get enough traffic to get the funding that these companies need? And they got lucky in the sense that a couple really cool projects decided to try them out. Because I, you know, on one level you're like, what's the risk? Let's go for it. You know,
so right.
Hebble was obviously a huge influencer on that. Which at the time, I remember reading an article where everyone was like, Pebble's amazing. It's the next big thing. Which it is cool. Don't get me wrong. And Pebble Steel is pretty awesome. But. I remember reading someone was like, no, Pebble's not the story here.
Yeah.
They go, they're a symptom of what's happening here. And they're like, Kickstarter's the story. And so, yeah, I'm with you. They totally deserve the award.
Right.
If they ever go, it'd be weird if they ever go public. I guess you can invest in it, but it's weird.
Yeah. But well, yeah, anyways. It's funny. This is off topic. I don't have the article, but it's, you know, talking about all this. GoPro is going to IPO soon. They just announced they're going to IPO soon, right? And and why do you IPO? There's one or two reasons. You're either Facebook and you're paying off your early investors, or yep. You know, generally the reason you do it is because you're raising capital for something.
Right.
And, you know, what would Kickstarter raise capital for at this point? I mean, they're doing crazy good. And I'm sure, yeah, that would be weird, but it's, you know, it's...
Well, it might be they want to scale their services. They want to add
yes.
You know, something else to it, to where, like, you can imagine they create an entire back-end platform to help startups be successful.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a good
where
point.
Instead of going to like the new Disney Accelerator or something like that, you go, well, yeah, we're going to do Kickstarter, we're going to get the funding, and then Kickstarter's got resources to help us actually, you know, now that you have $1 million, here's what to look out for, you know, and you know what I mean, and like and people to help out. So I could see that. I could see them wanting to expand internationally as well, kind of tap into the old Chinese marketplace, and that would require some capital to be able to do that. So there's always reasons to get money, and I can see a couple easy ones with them, but I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. I think they're still just kind of riding the wave and trying to figure out what we have.
One of the things that I love about that, what you just described, though, is the fact that it's a company that built a platform so you can fund projects. So basically, you're buying stock to give them money so they can fund projects. I mean, that's it's such a, you know, such a nesting doll of of this one idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. They're awesome. I love Kickstarter. I spend way more time than I should, you know, surfing their projects. Don't tell my boss.
That's cool. With the eventual hope of spending money on projects, right?
Yeah.
At least that's their goal.
Yeah, well, and I would say way too often I spend money. Yeah, sorry, did I just...
And so I'd like to transition to a new way, a new secure way to pay.
Oh, baby.
I got a new credit card, or a you know, not a new one, but a refreshed one. You know, when it expires and they send you a new one, whatever that correct term is. I got one of those in the mail. I'm going to conveniently cover up some numbers here.
Say.
But it's can you see that gold chip thing that's sitting
there? I recognize that. You want to know why I recognize that?
Because you got one too?
No, because I spend way too much time in Europe.
Ah, yes, that's right. That little gold chip, which at first I was like, I don't know what that is. And in it, they gave a description, and they were like, yeah, it's for when you travel abroad. This thing is useful because you can type in your PIN, to which I have no clue where that piece of paper went, so that's awesome. And because I haven't used it in the United States, but that's all going to change, and I'll have to find that PIN number. Because those are what's called a smart credit card, kind of. Smart in the sense that they are invented and in 1992 in France, and they haven't come out to the U.S. yet. So the way that the current system works is you got a credit card and you swipe it, and then depending on the company and the size of the expense, you then sign something, right? If you go to my local donut shop, even if you spend $2, they make you sign for it. If you go to Home Depot, it's only expenses over $20 or $50 they make you sign for it. I sign a lot at Home Depot, unfortunately. Yeah, and so the problem with that is that it uses the magnetic strip, and then it's just you're signing either a digital thing or a piece of paper, and it's relatively easy to commit fraud with that system.
Right.
And one of the biggest examples of that was the recent Target fiasco, I think is the right word for that, you know, where the 40 million customer credit card details were, you know, exposed. And that was actually, I think, the tipping point for Congress to say, you know what, I think it's time for us to adopt this European model, which is more secure. They were saying that the United States accounts for a quarter of all transactions worldwide, but has 50% of the fraud worldwide.
I believe it.
So that's just statistically significantly higher.
Yeah.
And they were saying, which I'm like, good, I'm glad they're being consistent. When France did roll this out, they saw their fraud drop 50% the very next year. I'm like, okay, math is consistent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the big difference is, again, it's this this little whatever that thing is called.
Smart chip.
Smart chip, thank you. Actually acts like an ATM PIN type thing, so it's encrypted and can actually change numbers on the fly depending on the transaction type that you're doing. And so there's that. And then there's a sign and swipe and then a PIN and swipe. And so, you know, the one model is you still sign it, so at least the transaction itself is encrypted, making it harder to you know, to take customer credit card details. And then the other one is a PIN, which is just like a debit card or an ATM card where you have a four digit number that you also have to code in. And so the idea being, you know, A, first you got to have this card that's encrypted, so it's hard to duplicate. And then B, you have to physically be there. And then, you know, C, you know, you have to know the PIN. So, like, it's just significantly more secure to do that.
Yeah.
And like I said, Europe's been doing it for a while. And the United States has finally said, or Visa and MasterCard have finally agreed with the United States, that by 2015, those will all be in use. Those smart cards will all be in use in the United States. So it's coming. Mm-hmm.
What I think is really interesting.
Go ahead.
All right. So what I think is really one of the things I think is interesting is that one of the biggest problems with it is that the fact that they're like the cards cost more to make, but it's not a very significant increase in cost. Obviously, any like a cent and a half per card for, you know, 100 million, you know, 300 million Americans is a significant amount of money, but it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, eh, over the time of the, you know, you do some things that kind of like balance it out. It's not that big of a deal. It's not billions of dollars. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not going to end the companies to do this. But their argument has always been, why would we do this? Why would we take on the expense of making the more expensive cars and building this infrastructure when nobody's going to upgrade their card readers because they're way more expensive?
So,
that is the billions of dollars of infrastructure, you know, cost that really makes it cost prohibitive.
Yeah. So there's two thoughts to that. So part of this deadline is something that they're going to have what's called liability shift. It's going to happen. And essentially it means whenever a card fraud happens, they'll determine who, you know, they need to determine who's liable for the cost, okay?
Right.
And so what'll happen is that if there is an incident, whichever party has the lesser technology will bear the liability.
Interesting.
So that's the big change in 2015, and that's the incentive for folks, for companies to upgrade. And what I find is interesting is they were interviewing people and they're like, yeah, we've got a multi-year rollout plan in order to do it. Cause like you said, it is genuinely expensive and we're like, dude, you have like less than it. Well, I guess it's October of 2015. So they've got a little over a year to do it. Okay. Like a year and a half to do it. And, multi-year is longer than a year and a half. You know that, right? And, you know, but part of it's like, yeah, we don't have a choice. And I would imagine some of those are fairly low risk as well. And then I was talking with he's a manager, VP or something important for a local bank here. And he was talking about their ATM machines. And he goes, yeah, we're deciding to take them all out. And his reason, he goes, you know, we've done the stats and they're expensive to maintain and to keep up.
Is it a bank taking out their ATM machines?
This is a bank. It's a local bank. I mean, they're not a national bank.
Right.
They're still got a few dozen branches. And he goes, but what they found is because of the type of bank they are, he goes, we like customers to come into the branch and create a relationship and stuff like that. And he goes, but then even with the bigger ones, it's like, they've got apps now. You're not going to go to an ATM to deposit a check. You're just going to take a picture and be done. And so he was like, so they're not getting used as much. And he goes, and then plus, because of this rule, I forget the number that he put out there. It was either 50,000 or 500,000. I mean, like, and I think it was closer to the 500,000. He's like, that's how much it would cost us to upgrade all of our machines to do it. And he's like,
that's a lot.
So we just won't.
This could be. Wait a second. Go on.
Yeah. So I was just saying, you know, so I think a lot of companies will make that choice too, where they go, yeah, you know what? I don't know. I don't know how Square works or how they can make this work, but that might be where a lot of companies go, you know what? This is a great time to switch over to that because of those types of costs.
This may be one of the greatest coup d'etats that's ever happened. I am like super stoked about this because this
Bitcoin
is like,
Bitcoin's just going to come right in. Not that they're secure at all, apparently.
No. Well, it's funny. They're amazingly secure. So I'm just going to touch on this really, really super quickly. You know, like, cause this week, you know, the big announced Silk Road 2 got hacked and people lost thousands and thousands of Bitcoins. And everybody's like, oh, see, Bitcoin's not that secure. And everybody's like, hey, Bitcoin is secure. The Silk Road 2 wasn't secure. And as people are like actually like looking at it more and more and like kind of studying what's going on, like bank accounts are still being drained. The staff at Silk Road 2 are like not responding and everything. And everybody thinks that the guys that Silk Road 2 is basically a massive scam. Set up the thing and then get, you know, billions of or get millions of dollars in Bitcoins in and then just cash out, steal them all. So Bitcoin is secure. It's the websites that you use that can be insecure. But that wasn't actually my point was going to be. Basically, what's going to happen, this is what's going on. This is just crazy. I'm super stoked on this, right? The biggest argument for why e-wallets weren't practical is because the question has always been, how do you build the infrastructure for it? Phone has your money on it. How do you get it from your phone to somebody else's phone? And so everybody's been trying to create these really these low friction methods of doing it, whether it's the near field of communication on your Android phone, or whether it's Bluetooth with your iPhone. And so all these different things, these like really low cost thing, the low cost methods, put it in everybody's hands. Apple's plan is so transparent at this point, it's not even funny. Put it the system into every device, so everybody that has an iPad now has a money collection unit for iPhones, and because it's all on the open Bluetooth protocol, it works for Android too. It's like crazy. This is awesome. And this is like so clearly what's going on with Apple, and all of a sudden what you're going to do is you're going to force everybody in the entire nation in a 2-year period to upgrade to some sort of a new financial transaction thing. They're going to build Bluetooth. All they have to do is build Bluetooth and an NFC chip into every single one that they sell of these, and you will completely remake how we do financial transactions in America in a way that.
The question is, do you think that'll happen fast enough, or do you think that so you're a company and you're going to go, well, whatever Europe's using, we'll just buy that existing product because it's
right.
Cheap.
See, that's the question that this is the difficult part. Yeah, because it's like the timing, it's either going to be the biggest fizzle of all time, or it's going to be the greatest coup d'etat. Because it's exactly it. Can Apple in, the next 4 months, really and truly, when iOS 7 or 8 come or whatever we're going to be on, 8 comes out, can they announce their e-wallet in enough time and get people excited enough and basically start this conversation of this is a secure way to do financial transactions? Because if they wait till iOS 9, till 2015 to do this, they're going to completely miss the boat. And the worst part about it is now everybody will have already bought their new card reader and nobody will want to reinvest. Not only will you have missed a golden opportunity,
right,
but it will close the opportunities that were already there. It's going to be worse for adoption of e-wallets.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where credit card companies, MasterCard and Visa card might get relegated back to like, I don't even know what they would be doing. Literally, because they make all their money off of you swiping your card. And if they can get circumnavigated because,
Well, you'll still be using a credit card attached to that e-wallet, so they'll still have that.
Yeah, I guess. Well, maybe. I mean, you assume that, but why can't I just attach my bank account to my iPhone and go drink? PayPal effectively does that. PayPal's
But I mean, that's the same as a debit card, right? And
right. Well,
I just.
Why can't Capital One give me an account number that syncs to my, assuming I go through the ridiculously high interest rates of Capital One. why can't they, or why can't Bank of America just give me my credit line number that's not attached to a Visa credit card that goes through my iPhone? And, I think early on, the first stages of all of this, you're going to go through Visa, MasterCard, because it's easy and it's comfortable, and that's kind of how Apple rolls. They want things that seem easy and comfortable. But, long term, and when I say long term, I mean 5 to 10 years long term. Why would I still be using a credit card? What's the real advantage there other than them taking a little cut at it every time I use it? And, especially as a big company like, let's say McDonald's, McDaniels, they've got to upgrade all of their systems, right? Okay, we got to do this. We're going to put Bluetooth in it and we're going to make it compatible with the iPhone, iWallet, and whatever, Android's compatible, system that they come up with. And then they go, and every time you swipe your credit card, every time you use your credit card, we're paying 2 cents to Visa or MasterCard. I'll tell you all what, if you use something that doesn't require us to use your Visa or MasterCard, but just goes through the phone, we'll give you, 2 cent discount on your meal. And then, and just get people in the habit of, not using that. Maybe there's a possibility.
I'm going to be the Debbie Downer and say it's not going to happen. But
saying. I mean, like, it's one of those things. I was going to say I don't know enough.
Theoretically, yes, it could. I don't think it will.
I don't know enough of the financial back end to know really. I mean, obviously, you know, Visa, MasterCard are like the, you know, kings of, you know, that, yeah. And they might be so instrumental in the backbone of financial transactions in America that it's laughable to suggest that they wouldn't be necessary at this point. You know, they might be like the telecoms where they're just, you know, they're just there and you'd never get rid of them. They are. And if you tried to get rid of them, you'd crush your own ability to spend money. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. You know, are they, but, that actually would be interesting to look into. I probably will, but this is the makings. If the tech companies can get on their game, this is the makings for some really radical changes in just how we all treat technology, which is exciting. And I like it. And if nothing else, we actually get to have, you know, more secure credit cards, and they won't look at me like I'm a freak when I walk into a pub in England with a swipe credit card. And they'll be like, I don't know how to take your money. Just please take my money. I don't care how you figure out how to do it. Just take it. That's what happens every time. Actually, the really other interesting thing is they legally cannot take your credit card out of your sight when you go to a restaurant. They all like these wireless card swipers that they bring to your table as opposed to like taking your credit card to the back. They're not legally allowed to take it out of your sight, so they can't steal your numbers, which is really smart. Don't know why that's not a law in America.
Kind of paranoid, but I just like the idea of them using the card. I think we should just all restaurants should invest in the Microsoft Surface. So all you do is put your card on the table. You can flick your bills around, put your card on the table, pay, done, move on.
Exactly. So,
Or they should treat it more like a hotel or something where when you make your reservation, they get your card real quick and they swipe it.
Right, exactly.
And